This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. Our guest on this edition of the program is Amy Hawthorne, Deputy Director for Research at the Project on Middle East Democracy, and that's a policy group based here in Washington. Amy is a Middle East expert with extensive policy and practical experience on Arab political reform and democracy promotion. We'll be talking with Amy on this edition of the program about the status of Tunisia and Egypt, 7 years after their respective populations toppled authoritarian leaders Zine El Abidine Ben Ali and Hosni Mubarak, sparking what has come to be known as the Arab Spring. So why, 7 years on, are Tunisians back on the streets? While they have more political freedom, GDP per person has barely budged since the revolution. A package of tax increases affecting dozens of consumer goods that took effect on January 1st, along with rising fuel prices, ignited the unrest. The government of President Beji Caid Essebsi argues that it needed to shrink the budget and that many of the austerity measures are aimed at the wealthy, but that has not mollified the protesters. And 7 years after ebullient crowds demonstrated in Cairo's Tahrir Square to overthrow longtime President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, the country is facing more sober political, economic, and security choices as it prepares for fresh elections in March. Analysts say, for the most part, that the vote will be a referendum on the popularity of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Well, we'll talk with Amy Hawthorne about the situations in both Tunisia and Egypt and the significance of these two countries for both regional and global stability. And of course, Amy is no stranger to the Voice of America, so we are delighted to welcome her back to Press Conference USA. Amy, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Carol.
And I'm always delighted to welcome my colleague and in-house Middle East North African expert, Mohammed El-Shanawi.
Thank you.
Well, Amy, here we are back at the studio talking about Tunisia in particular, and later on Egypt. Tunisia, the birthplace of the Arab Spring, 7 years on. What is your take on what exactly sparked the most recent unrest in the streets in Tunisia?
What sparked the unrest earlier this month in Tunisia, and the unrest was across the country in all different regions of Tunisia, was discontent, mostly among young Tunisians, about the economic situation, which is stagnating and for many Tunisians actually getting more difficult. The protesters are angry that the Tunisian government is raising prices on everyday goods and services while not, in their eyes, taking enough serious action to deal with mass high-level corruption among business leaders and top officials. So there's a lot of anger about the government's policies, austerity measures, and also lack of action, in their eyes, against corruption, which they believe drains far more money from state coffers than prices of the government subsidies of widespread consumer goods.
What's your take in terms of how justified they are in these critiques? What about this corruption? We thought that that was going to be tackled after Ben Ali, who was probably one of the most corrupt leaders, in addition to his family and cronies. Has anything been done in that area?
Very little has been done against corruption by successive Tunisian governments, and I believe that Tunisia is now on either its seventh or eighth prime minister since 2011, so there's been a lot of turnover in governance. You know, in my view, they are justified in being frustrated and angry, because although Tunisian leaders since 2011 have taken some small steps to deal with the problem of corruption, they really have not tackled the issue in any serious or comprehensive manner. Very, very few allegedly corrupt figures have been put on trial. Even fewer have been convicted. There's a feeling that many people responsible for corruption in the Ben Ali regime have impunity, and there's nothing stopping them from continuing their corrupt acts. So there is a lot of frustration among many, many Tunisians about the lack of serious comprehensive action against corruption.
Amy, a public opinion survey conducted recently by the International Republican Institute showed that a majority of Tunisians prefer a better economy to a democratic system of government. What does that mean?
This is a trend that has been building up in recent years in Tunisia. There's a lot of different ways to read those poll results. On the one hand, I believe that a lot of Tunisians actually, like people everywhere, in fact, do place their everyday economic situation above political concerns. On the other hand, there is strong support among a lot of Tunisians for continuing on a democratic path. And if you dig a little bit deeper and speak with Tunisians, many, not all, but most Tunisians will say that they don't believe that an authoritarian government like what they had before can actually address economic problems. So although there's a lot of discontent with this current government and its approach, there's also a sense among a lot of Tunisians, especially the younger generation, that the Ben Ali style of governance isn't good for the economy either.
But the majority of Tunisians has unfavorable ratings of leading political parties in the current government. What kind of message Tunisians are sending to the current coalition?
Tunisians are sending a message that they're frustrated with formal politics. They're frustrated with formal political parties. There are upcoming local elections, the first since the revolution this spring. And it'll be very interesting to watch the turnout in those elections and see whether these discontented and frustrated Tunisians turn to the ballot box to select different leaders for their municipal government, or whether they stay home and decide not to take part in the process. So signs of growing frustration with democratic politics is concerning. It is also very, very, very typical in new democracies and transition countries.
7 years after the Tunisian revolution, 83% of Tunisians feel the country is going in the wrong direction. How do you explain that?
I explain it in a number of ways. First of all, there is a lot of frustration among many Tunisians about the economic situation and a sense that a revolution that was waged for dignity, political freedom, but also social justice and economic improvement has not met its promise in that last realm of social justice and economic progress. There's widespread discontent. I also think that it's possible now in Tunisia for people to express their opinions freely, and they do so very freely. There is genuine freedom of speech in Tunisia. And just like in the United States, if we're not happy with our government, we would tell pollsters that. Or if we like the government, we would tell pollsters that. In Tunisia, I think a lot of Tunisians feel a lot more comfortable expressing their honest opinion. So that is a bit of a positive sign, and also that there are these polls that are taken that show very high levels of frustration with the government, and the Tunisian authorities don't suppress the polls. They allow them to be published and debated. So that's healthy. But the level of frustration is an area for concern, for sure.
Amy, I've heard analysts say that Tunisia must do more to disentangle the state from the economy, that 20% of workers have jobs in the public sector. In a country with so much potential in the private sector, whether in tourism or in other areas, what's your take on that? And to what extent is the government addressing this problem?
Some Tunisians view this type of economy as a problem, and others see it as the Tunisian economy that should be. There's a very long tradition in Tunisia since independence from France under their first president, Habib Bourguiba, of a strong state role in the economy, a strong public sector, and with government jobs being the job that is desired by many Tunisians for stability, relatively high pay. On the other hand, there is a lot of evidence that this type of economic model with a very large public sector and with a lot of state control over key economic sectors has actually contributed to Tunisia's economic slump. There's a debate underway in Tunisia about the best way forward, but it's very difficult when a lot of Tunisians are unemployed and the government traditionally has been the main employer. It's difficult for people who are looking for a job to be told the government's not going to hire you anymore. So it's a painful transition from one type of economic model to another, but by no means is there full support among the Tunisian populace for a private sector-led economy. That's a very controversial idea in Tunisia. People associate that with insecurity, with corruption, with injustice, because wages in the private sector are generally lower and there are less worker protections. So there's a debate underway in Tunisia about the right economic model for the country going forward.
As a longtime observer of Tunisia, Amy, how would you advise the government? What is your take on the way it could both preserve those public sector jobs, but also perhaps cut red tape and encourage more private sector investment and entrepreneurial opportunities?
Well, private sector-led growth and entrepreneurship are really key engines of economic growth and job creation in Tunisia that are good for the long run. But as I said, these ideas are sometimes viewed with apprehension by some Tunisians. I think the most important thing for Tunisian officials to keep in mind is that there's a very strong sense among the Tunisian population about social and economic justice. So a government policy that works to enlarge the private sector and free up entrepreneurs will be welcomed by a lot of Tunisians if it creates good jobs and if it includes a strong measure of social justice, meaning worker protections, fair wages. That will be met with more satisfaction by a lot of Tunisians than an economy that doesn't have really any protections for the average worker.
It seems like that's a doable thing. Who do you blame for the unrest that we're seeing, the frustration? What is the role, for example, of international organizations, the IMF? Do you think that their advice to the government is, to some extent, has played a part in what we're seeing?
It's very, very complicated because most economists say in Tunisia, there isn't really another path to job creation. Really, the only way to create jobs for the, say, 15 to 20% of Tunisians who are unemployed is by private sector-led growth. On the other hand, a lot of Tunisians say we followed the IMF program under Ben Ali. We were considered a model student of the IMF, and look where that got us. It got us in a very bad economic situation where a few wealthy Tunisians did very well, and most Tunisians didn't do so well. So there is a valid critique of the IMF approach in Tunisia. There's also a lack of real other options in terms of how to create jobs, which is very important. Right now, there's a real disconnect between the elected politicians who sit in parliament, who vote for these IMF-mandated measures, and a lot of Tunisian young people, some of the people who have been in the streets, who say, we don't trust the IMF, this doesn't make Tunisia wealthier, we don't believe in an austerity approach. So there's a debate underway. There are political actors in Tunisia who have been in power for a long time, who still make decisions and hold control, who don't necessarily always think of the best interests of the citizens who are less well off. And that's the anger that you're seeing in the streets.
That brings another question. Although former Tunisian President Ben Ali fled the country 7 years ago, his close associates are participating in ruling post-revolution Tunisia. What do you make of that?
Well, this is both Tunisia's curse and blessing. It's a curse because there are these figures from the old regime, the ancien regime, who, after a little bit of time on the sidelines, came back into power in certain positions. Some of these people are highly controversial and highly disliked by many Tunisians. And some Tunisians I talk to blame the presence of these people for some of the, let's say, regressive policies that have been occurring of late. Police abuse, clampdown on the freedom of speech. They say there's no room for these people in the new Tunisia. They have no place in our democratic government. The blessing, Beji Caid Essebsi, the president, would say this, is that these figures are experienced. They know how to run the government, and we need them to manage our country at this time. I think the problem with that explanation is that these figures were in power before. The result was not good. It is, in my personal view, better for Tunisia to allow new figures, new talent, new voices to come in instead of relying on the very same small elite that has basically held power in Tunisia for a long time. So this is a very controversial issue, the return of Ben Ali figures, as they call them, to positions of power.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Amy Hawthorne. She's Deputy Director for Research at the Project on Middle East Democracy. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Mohammed El-Shanawi, VOA Senior Middle East Reporter. And this is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener Taleb Gormil, and he's listening in Kuwait. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, before we turn over to Egypt, Amy, just one more question with respect to Tunisia. We also know that Ennahda, the Islamist party, has been and I believe continues to be part of the current government. How would you assess their role? And a corollary question, what about the international community? Is there anything the international community, the United States, could do to help Tunisia? Because it's very important that Tunisia is successful in the mid and long term.
So with regard to the role of Ennahda, which is the Islamist party in Tunisia, this is a positive development in Tunisia that this Islamist party, which was outlawed, severely repressed during Ben Ali government, is now co-governing the country, is fully legal, is fully integrated into the political system, actually remarkably smoothly, notwithstanding some tough times and some tensions. This party has become part of the political elite that used to be fiercely anti-Islamist and to repress it harshly. It is now fully integrated. This is a positive thing. Tunisia has handled this issue, in my view, extraordinarily maturely and very well. On the other hand, there are some Tunisians who complain that Ennahda has now become part of the ruling class and is not really standing up for rights and freedoms and reforms that it should be standing up for as a former opposition party. For example, the recent protests across Tunisia about economic austerity, the Ennahda leadership criticized the protests and basically called on people more or less not to go out into the streets and not to be too critical of the government in so many words. Many Tunisians were very dismayed when they heard this, and they were hoping that Ennahda would more support their rights and their demands. So there's some discontent with Ennahda that it is becoming too much part of the establishment and not critical enough of some of the democratic backsliding that we see in Tunisia. When you talk to Ennahda members themselves, they say, yes, we have integrated into the ruling structure. We are members of this cabinet. We're the largest single party in parliament at the moment. But we still fear that there could still be a backlash. We never know what's going to happen. Our role could suddenly become vulnerable. And therefore, we think the best protection for us is to be part of the political system and cooperate and work constructively. So the role of Ennahda remains actually a fascinating one in Tunisia. With regard to the international community, my strong view is that the international community, the community of democracies around the world, should continue to support Tunisia, but it needs to pay much closer attention to what is actually taking place in the country. There are really serious economic problems. There are very serious problems with corruption. There are very serious problems with police abuse and arrests and suppression of peaceful dissent that really has no role in a country that is transitioning toward democracy. It was very dismaying to me that after the latest protests, in which I think something like 900 people were arrested, credible allegations of police brutality against protesters, against demonstrators, not one single Western government had a comment about these protests. Only the UN High Commissioner for the Human Rights criticized the high number of arrests. So the international community should support Tunisia, but we should also speak out and hold Tunisia accountable to its own democratic commitments, which it is falling short in recent months.
Let me turn now to Mohammed on Egypt. And Mohammed just came back, so he is also full of information and analysis.
Yeah, well, despite all the challenges, Tunisia remains the only success story in the Arab Spring. Why did Egypt fail to emulate the Tunisian model of democratic transition?
This question, why Tunisia succeeded, Egypt failed, is the subject of PhD dissertations, articles, books. It's such a fascinating question, and I still don't think 7 years later we have the full answer. But I would point to two factors that I think are very important that have helped Tunisia on its way and led to Egypt's political demise. First, the Tunisian military in recent decades has been a weak political actor. It does not seek to govern. It does not seek political power. Once the revolution happened in Tunisia, the army did not try to step in and run the country. Power was immediately in the hands of civilian politicians, and the military had a role in protecting the national security. In Egypt, of course, the military immediately took power, ruled for 18 months, and now continues to be the main political power in the country, which in my view is very destructive, very anti-democratic. So Tunisia is fortunate in that way. Another way in which Tunisia was fortunate, ironically, is that because it's a small country that is not a top security priority for the United States, Europe, Gulf countries, Tunisia was a little bit protected from the regional counter-revolution. So whereas in Egypt we saw Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates immediately upset about Mubarak's departure, Mubarak's resignation, and immediately trying to work to restore a authoritarian regime to power. In Tunisia, we didn't see that same kind of interference because Tunisia is not as important to those countries, in their view, security. So Tunisia had less negative and counterproductive international interference, and this was also a blessing for Tunisia.
But some experts see that the military coup undid the Egyptian revolution. Is there any chance for the Egyptian military to pull out of its heavy involvement in both economy and politics in Egypt?
No chance anytime soon of the Egyptian military pulling out of its dominant role in politics and in the economy. This dominant role that the military has played in Egypt's political life has been basically since the 1950s. Its economic role has been growing for the past, you know, 2-3 decades. This is a major, major facet of Egyptian life. In my view, it is very detrimental to Egypt's political development and its economic development. But any transition of the Egyptian military from this role to a purely security role will take a very long time and be very complicated because the people who hold power never want to give it up easily, and there's a lot at stake.
Talking about that, in recent fact sheet issued by Program on Middle East Democracy, there was an accusation that Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is purging political candidates in Egypt's upcoming elections. On what basis was that accusation?
Well, it's remarkable. President Sisi has decided that he wants to hold an election in March to be reelected. Some dictators don't bother to hold an election, or they do what Mubarak used to do, which is hold a referendum. Yes, no, me, no one else. Sisi has decided he wants to have an election, and he said that it should be competitive and Egyptians should have choices. So lo and behold, 6 different candidates came forward to challenge him to run as his competitor in the election, which is allowed in the Egyptian political system since 2004. Sisi, it turns out, doesn't actually want any competition. The fact that several of these would-be candidates came from the military was even more apparently threatening to him. And so using a variety of measures and tricks and means, the Egyptian authorities have managed to either disqualify on very shaky grounds these would-be candidates, or has intimidated, threatened, and pressured them, their families, and their supporters, leading them to pull out. So to be blunt about it, what the upcoming presidential vote is a farce because there's no competition. There's no real reason to hold the election if Sisi is so determined to hold power and to repress anyone who even comes forward, although many analysts believe that Sisi actually might be able to win a free election because he does have support among many Egyptians, that this sort of farcical event of having Egyptians come out and say they want him for another 4 years with no competition is a waste of time and money. So the election is turning into just a giant farce.
Well, Amy, as we close, stepping back, how concerned are you about this trend that we're seeing, particularly in Egypt, return to authoritarianism, military rule, notwithstanding the progress in Tunisia? Also, I'm sure there's a sense of disappointment after the hope of the Arab Spring. How do you see all of this playing out? And also the role of the international community, perhaps not speaking out enough, sort of just accepting this sense of apparent stability, but we know stability is not as stable as it appears.
All Arab countries, to one degree or another, face incredibly daunting and serious economic, social, and security challenges, and significant youth populations who want a better future. They want more social freedom. They want more economic opportunity, political freedom. Unfortunately, authoritarian rule in this part of the world, we've already seen, has been an utter failure, an utter disaster to address these problems. When you travel to the Middle East and meet people, you see how rich and amazing the human capital, the human talent in these countries is. Why is it that this part of the world is so far behind economically than almost any other part of the world? Well, it's because of bad governance. That is the main reason. Authoritarian rule will not help these countries move forward into the 21st century. And it actually is the basis for conflict, war, death. The problem is that authoritarian rule can work in the short run in terms of suppressing and keeping control. And so I believe that the international community, exhausted by the past 7 years in the Middle East, exhausted by the Syrian civil war, the tumult in Libya, the chaos at one point in Egypt when Egypt was in turmoil. The international community is exhausted and is focused on short-term solutions. We've even seen in Iran, not part of the Arab world, but an important nearby country, that people there are very unhappy with that theocracy, and they rose up to express their discontent. So we can be sure that another wave of change and popular unrest will be coming. The international community, sadly, will probably be behind the curve. And once that happens, we'll then have to react. But we are in a sad moment now that the people who really have good solutions for the future of the Arab world, in my view, are those who are being suppressed and thrown in prison. So it's a difficult time for the region.
In terms of supporting real Democrats, that is, not necessarily political Islamists, but those in the middle, why is it that we, whether it's the United States or other Western countries, cannot seem to truly help them emerge? Because that would be perhaps part of the answer.
It is part of the answer. And those people do exist. They are not the majority in any Arab country, but they're a significant minority. And younger Arabs who have come to their political awakening during the Arab uprisings very much adhere to these ideas of democracy. So the trend is slowly moving in the direction of more young people being interested in democratic rights and freedoms than fewer. The problem is, I think, twofold. For one thing, the United States is a very controversial and sometimes toxic actor in this part of the world. And sometimes Arab Democrats fear that an embrace from the United States would actually not help them politically at home, because U.S. policies are often so controversial in the Middle East. The second challenge is that often the U.S. government and European governments are no different. When they stand up for these people, these Democrats, these human rights defenders in Arab societies, and I assure you that there are many of them, I talk to them on a daily basis across the region, Arab regimes get very frustrated, angry, and they push back. And a lot of Western governments don't want to deal with that blowback, and so they back off. So it takes a certain kind of fortitude to continue to press for these rights and freedoms, knowing that our security partners in Kuwait or Egypt or Morocco or Jordan are going to be unhappy with us if we do so. But it really is the right long-term strategy, and I'd like to see the U.S. and Europe actually doing a lot more in that regard.
Amy Hawthorne is Deputy Director for Research at the Project on Middle East Democracy here in Washington, and I would say one of the most articulate and incisive voices on the Middle East.
Thanks, Carol. Thanks, Mohammed.
Press Conference USA on The Voice of America was produced here in Washington, thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Zubair El Tayeb. Joining me on the program was Mohammed El Shenawi, VOA Senior Middle East Reporter. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on The Voice of America.